Chapter 4. Traveling North. I don't know what Tweel thought of my sleeping. He sat around, but when I woke up, he was gone. I'd just crawled out of my bag, though, when I heard some trilling and clacking, and there he came sailing down from that high thyle cliff to land on his beak beside me. I pointed to myself and toward the north, and he pointed at himself and toward the south. But when I loaded up and started away, he came along. Man, how he traveled! 150 feet at a jump, sailing through the air, stretched out like a spear and landing on his beak. He seemed surprised at my slow progress, but after a few moments he fell in beside me. Only every few minutes he'd go into one of his leaps and stick his nose into the sand a block ahead of me. Then he'd come shooting back at me. It made me nervous at first to see that beak of his coming at me like a spear, but he always ended in the sand at my side. So the two of us moved steadily along across the Mare Cronium. Same sort of place as this, with the same crazy plants and the same little green biopods growing in the sand or crawling out of your way. We talked, not that we understood each other, you know, but just for company. I sang songs, and I suspect Tweel did too. At least some of his trilling had a subtle sort of rhythm. Then, for variety, Tweel would display his small number of English words. He'd point to a big stone in the ground and say, "Rock," and point to a tiny rock and say it again. Or he'd touch my arm and say, "Tick," and then repeat it. He seemed greatly amused that the same word meant the same thing twice in succession, or that the same word could apply to two different objects, and it set me wondering if perhaps his language wasn't like that of some earth people, like some African tribes, for instance, who haven't any general words. No word for food or water or man. They have words for good food and bad food, or rainwater and seawater, or strong man and weak man, but no names for general classes. They don't understand that rainwater and seawater are just different aspects of the same thing. But that wasn't the case with Tweel. It was just that we were somehow mysteriously different. Our minds were alien to each other, and yet we liked each other. "Crazy, that's all," remarked Harrison. "That's why you two liked each other so much." "Well, I like you," countered Jarvis jokingly. "Anyway," he resumed, "don't get the idea that there was anything wrong with Tweel. In fact, I'm not so sure that he couldn't teach our highly praised human intelligence a thing or two. Oh, he wasn't the most intelligent creature, I guess, but don't miss the point that he managed to understand a little of my mental workings, and I never even got the smallest idea about his." "Because he didn't have any," suggested the captain, while Putz and Leroy listened closely. "You can judge about that when I'm through," said Jarvis. Well, we traveled along across the Mare Cronium all that day and all the next. Mare Cronium, it means the Sea of Time. Say, I was ready to agree with Schiaparelli's title by the end of that march. Just that gray, endless plain of strange plants and never a sign of any other life. It was so dull that I was even glad to see the desert of Xanthus toward the evening of the second day. I was nearly worn out, but Tweel seemed as fresh as ever, and I never saw him drink or eat. I think he could have crossed the Mare Cronium in a couple of hours with those block-long leaps of his, but he stuck along with me. I offered him some water once or twice, but he just took the cup from me and sucked the liquid into his beak, and then carefully squirted it all back into the cup and returned it. Just as we sighted Xanthus, or the cliffs that bounded it, one of those nasty sand clouds blew along. Not as bad as the one we had here, but hard to travel against. I pulled the transparent flap of my thermal coat across my face and managed pretty well, and I noticed that Tweel used some feathers growing at the base of his beak to cover his nostrils and similar feathers to protect his eyes. "He is a desert creature," said the little biologist Leroy. "Huh? Why?" "He drinks no water. He is adapted for sandstorms." "Proves nothing. There's not enough water to waste anywhere on this dried-out pill called Mars. We'd call all of it desert on Earth, you know." He paused. "Anyway, after the sandstorm blew over, A little wind kept blowing in our faces, not strong enough to stir the sand, but suddenly things came drifting along from the Xanthus cliffs. They were small, transparent, and round, just like glass tennis balls, but they were almost light enough to float even in this thin air. They were empty, too. At least I cracked open a couple, and nothing came out but a bad smell. I asked Tweel about them, but all he said was, "No, no, no," which I took to mean that he knew nothing about them. So they went bouncing by on the wind, and we continued on toward Xanthus. Tweel pointed at one of the crystal balls once and said, "Rock," but I was too tired to argue with him. Later, I discovered what he meant. We finally came to the bottom of the Xanthus cliffs when there wasn't much daylight left, and I decided to sleep on the plateau if possible. Anything dangerous, I reasoned, would be more likely to hunt among the plants of the Maracronium than the sand of Xanthus, not that I'd seen a single sign of danger except the rope-armed black thing that had trapped Tweel, and apparently that didn't hunt at all, but lured its victim within reach. It couldn't lure me while I slept, especially as Tweel didn't seem to sleep at all, but simply sat around patiently all night. I wondered how the creature had managed to trap Tweel, but there wasn't any way of asking him. I found that out later, and it's horrible. However, we were walking slowly around the base of the Xanthus barrier, looking for an easy spot to climb, at least I was. Tweel could have leaped it easily, for the cliffs were lower than Thyle by perhaps 60 feet. I found a place and started up, cursed at the water tank strapped to my back. It didn't bother me except when climbing, and suddenly I heard a sound that I thought I recognized. You know how easy it is to mistake sounds in this thin air. A shot sounds like opening a bottle, but this was the sound of a rocket, and sure enough, there went our second extra rocket about 10 miles to the west between me and the setting sun. "It was me," said Putz. "I was hunting for you." Yeah, I knew that, but what good did it do me? I hung on to the cliff and shouted and waved with one hand. Tweel saw it too and started making a lot of noise, leaping to the top of the barrier and then high into the air. And while I watched, the machine flew on into the shadows to the south. I scrambled to the top of the cliff. Tweel was still pointing and trilling excitedly, shooting up toward the sky and coming down head-on to stick upside down on his beak in the sand. I pointed toward the south and at myself, and he said, "Yes, yes, yes." But somehow I gathered that he thought the flying thing was a relative of mine, probably a parent, though perhaps I did his mind an injustice. I think now that I did. I was bitterly disappointed by the failure to attract attention. I pulled out my thermal bag and crawled into it, as the night chill was already apparent. Tweel stuck his beak into the sand and drew up his legs and arms and looked for all the world like one of those low trees out there. I think he stayed that way all night.